We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, April 30th, and the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas and a few other players continues to rage, and this coming as the United States under Joe Biden's administration is not really having a great pro-Israel response. This morning, Secretary of State Antony Blinken urges Hamas to accept a quote-unquote extraordinarily generous ceasefire deal as Israel prepares for battle in Rafah. This coming from the Washington Examiner. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged Hamas to accept the latest ceasefire proposal, which he described as extraordinarily generous for them. The U.S. is among a group of countries, including Qatar and Egypt, that have acted as mediators for months between Israel and Hamas, but have been unable to get both sides to agree to a ceasefire deal dating back to December. Blinken said this: Hamas has a proposal that is extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel, and they have to decide quickly, and I'm hopeful they will make the right decision and we can have a fundamental change in the dynamic. This also coming as the Biden administration accuses Israel military of human rights violations in a stunning condemnation yesterday. The State Department finding comes as anti-Israel protests are continuing to sweep college campuses. This is what the State Department and their spokesperson had to say. This is cut one.
What I can say in terms of where the process is right now is that after a careful process, we found five Israeli units responsible for individual incidents of gross violations of human rights. All of these were incidents much before October 7th, and none took place in Gaza. Four of these units have effectively remediated these violations, which is what we expect partners to do. It is consistent with what we expect all countries whom with we have a security relationship with. For a remaining unit, we continue to be in consultations and engagements with the government of Israel. They have submitted additional information as it pertains to that unit, and we're continuing to have those conversations.
This also coming as the International Criminal Court is moving to indict Netanyahu and Israeli leaders for war crimes. The International Criminal Court is preparing arrest warrants for senior Israeli officials for alleged war crimes, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, according to Newsmax World, a revelation that has drawn silence, if not acceptance, from the Biden administration. Sources told the New York Times the charges stem from Israel preventing delivery of humanitarian aid, which Israeli officials have said they fear just winds up in the hands of Hamas terrorists amid the war started by Hamas's October 7th terrorist attack. So Netanyahu reportedly is on the list of Israeli government officials to be issued ICC arrest warrants. So joining me now to talk about the International Criminal Court and how they could possibly have jurisdiction over this conflict and over these alleged war crimes is Mike Donnelly, who is a law professor and has litigated in foreign courts himself. And so, Mike, really appreciate your time this morning. So let's start first with, you know, what is the ICC and how are they purportedly preparing to indict Netanyahu in the midst of this conflict?
Well, hi, Janet. It's good to be with you. The International Criminal Court was created by a treaty called the Rome Statute around 2002 by about 123 countries that signed on to the Rome Statute. The United States and Israel actually originally signed on to the Rome Statute, which I prefer to call a treaty, but then subsequently withdrew their signatures. And so neither the United States nor Israel are currently parties to the treaty. So the question, how does the ICC even have jurisdiction apart from what the ICC is? And we can certainly talk about that, too, is a question. But the ICC comes from this statute, the Rome Statute, and the purpose of the court really stems from, at least people say it stems from, the Nuremberg trials, the Tokyo trials, where the United States after World War II held trials to, hand out justice to individuals who committed at the time what people called war crimes. The Nazis who killed, the Jews and committed the Holocaust, the atrocities that happened in Asia under Japan's invasion of China. And there were individuals who did things that were so heinous that the United States wanted to hold these individuals accountable, and not just as a victor. Now, the idea was that, this isn't just the victorious United States coming in and exercising its own will on the Nazis or on the Japanese. But it was, did these individuals intend their actions? Were these actions that they did actual atrocities under international law at the time? And then they were, tried by a judge, and then they were sentenced. Many were sentenced. There were a few that were not held to that standard. And so you have the Nuremberg trials, the Tokyo trials, and fast forward, you have the United Nations coming out of World War II. And since then, there have been conflicts, and there's been work done in the United Nations and in the international community to create tribunals. And so since then, you've had some international criminal tribunals dealing with situations. So, for example, in Rwanda, in Yugoslavia, there were international tribunals set up to adjudicate war crimes. Even as this is happening, you have people at the United Nations, states at the United Nations calling for a permanent international court. And out of that came the Rome Statute, was finished in 1998, and then 123 countries have signed on. And so what is the court supposed to do? The court has four crimes under its jurisdiction. It's got genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and a new crime that has recently been agreed to by the countries that make up the court, called the crime of aggression. And that's a list of, when you look at the statute, you can see there are scores of different crimes that are listed. And the court is, it goes through a process. It's got a prosecutor, the office of a prosecutor that's supposed to investigate crimes. It's got a pretrial committee that then issues warrants if they're warranted, which is kind of where people are saying it is. And I guess we can come back to that, because I looked on the ICC website. I did not see any mention of an investigation into Israel's actions or any actions there. And so before any arrest warrants could be issued, the prosecutor would have to go through and investigate to see whether there was sufficient evidence of a crime and whether the court would have jurisdiction. Now, Israel's not a party, as I've said before, so how can it have jurisdiction if Israel's not even a party? Well, here's how. In 2015, the International Criminal Court members allowed Palestine to become a member of the International Criminal Court. Now, how can they do that? Palestine's not even a state. Well, they decided they were going to let Palestine in as an observer. And, of course, the PLO was admitted to observer status in the United Nations at one point, and now you've got, different entities claiming to be the governing entity of Palestine. And I'll tell you, I'm not an expert on Palestine and Israel conflict, but it is a history that I think people need to understand when you're looking at this issue of holding people accountable. And I think there's a lot of people who would point at Palestine and say, hold up, if your guys are going to be recognized as a state, what you did on October 7th also needs to be in the mix. And I'd like to hear people talking about that, as much as if people want to talk about Israel, okay, they're defending themselves. But what about what Palestine did? Isn't that a crime against humanity, the Hamas terrorists? So that's kind of, that's the ICC, that's what it's for. And, you know, whether there are going to be investigations or not, I don't know. I don't see it on the ICC court's website. I understand this is from a report made by the New York Times. So I think we need to be careful. And I haven't heard anything coming out of the court itself. I mean, I haven't seen anything. Maybe you have.
Well, so I have a lot of questions here. I mean, the jurisdictional question is certainly one of them. And this, especially in the midst of this conflict, I mean, we all are familiar with the Nuremberg trials and, you know, some of these things that took place well after the fact. And can the ICC come in and issue these types of arrest warrants? I mean, jurisdictional questions aside, do this in the midst of a conflict that would certainly have a chilling effect and other collateral consequences on Israel's ability to respond to Hamas and engage in this conflict? I mean, if they're literally trying to arrest the Israeli prime minister, I mean, that presents a problem.
Well, it would certainly be a problem for Israel, and I don't think the court should do that myself, but can it? Within the Rome Statute, there is no restriction on the court as to when it can issue an arrest warrant. There is a process, as I mentioned before, it has to go through. It has to go through an investigation. So the Office of the Prosecutor, there's only one prosecutor. His name is Karim Khan. He's a British national who's the current prosecutor. He has to go through an investigation. So there has and there has to be a referral, or the prosecutor has to investigate. So the court can receive referrals for crimes, the crimes listed, genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, or the crime of aggression, from member states, which Israel's not one, and Palestine, you know, someone in Palestine apparently is representing Palestine. So they can refer a request for investigation. The prosecutor can take it up under his own power, or the UN Security Council can refer a matter. I'm not aware that any referral has been made. I don't see that the prosecutor's office has issued any kind of statement saying that it's investigating Israel's actions or anyone's actions in this process. So, you know, is this preemptive public relations? I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, the New York Times is reporting that some Israelis have said that they're concerned that this could happen. It's certainly possible. Should it? I doubt it. And I honestly don't think it's going to be. I don't know. I'm very skeptical that the ICC is going to issue arrest warrants anytime soon. It has to go through an investigation first. It's got to look at evidence before it can actually do that. It has to go to a pretrial commission before arrest warrants can actually be issued. And that takes some time. I'm not aware of that it's actually started that process.
And I'm speaking with Mike Donnelly, who is a law professor and also an attorney, and has litigated in foreign courts as well, and wrote a really excellent piece that I want to talk to you about in the next segment. We only have a couple of minutes here before we have to take a break on human rights. And you know, as you're describing, Mike, some of these crimes that the ICC has jurisdiction over. And I think you're right to be skeptical of this. I'm not as perhaps convinced that, you know, some of these things aren't going to just be pushed through the process. I mean, it seems like the ICC could be the international version of, you know, Jack Smith in terms of lawfare and in terms of the political persuasion and trying to put pressure on Israel and push through their own agenda for this conflict. So that's also a question. I mean, is there a political bent or bias to the composition of the ICC?
Well, it's 123 states, and the big ones are not in it. Of course, Russia's not in it. China's not in it. India's not. The U.S. is not. You know, Israel's not. Half the world are not in the ICC. And the ICC has been criticized for bias. It has focused most of its activity on Africa. And one of the things that I'll just say this, one of the important parameters that the court has to discover when it's looking at taking a case is that the party that is being accused of the crime is not able to or is unwilling to hold the person who's committing the crime accountable. Now, Israel certainly is capable of holding anyone who's committing war crimes accountable, but they're not a part of the treaty. So, you know, in Palestine, I'm not sure that they are. But I think you're fair. I think it's fair for you to wonder about this, because you do see that. And it's not a new idea. I mean, look back in 2005, a British court issued an arrest warrant for an Israeli major general alleging war crimes committed against Palestinians.
Mike, we'll take a break here real quick, and then we'll be right back on the flip side to talk more about the International Criminal Court and some of these really important national sovereignty issues right here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are talking about one of the top headlines from yesterday. The ICC is potentially moving, or reportedly moving, to indict Benjamin Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders for war crimes, and talking about what is the International Criminal Court, how could they potentially have jurisdiction in this, coming as a former Secretary of State under the Trump administration, Mike Pompeo, has posted on X, the broken and corrupt ICC is looking to bring charges against Israel for defending itself against terrorism. The Trump admin was right to sanction the ICC, and Biden was wrong to lift them. Biden should immediately reinstate the sanctions against the ICC. So my guest this morning is Mike Donnelly, who is a law professor, Copper, who is giving his commentary in the background, my little golden doodle. And Mike, you are not a golden doodle, so that's not part of your resume, but you are also an attorney and have litigated in foreign courts. Yes, there you go. And so we're talking about this. And one of the other questions that I have as well is, you know, you mentioned in the last segment these charges that the ICC can bring, and it seems to me just the terms that are being used, like human rights violations, can and maybe intentionally are very vague. And you've written extensively on human rights in a worldwide sort of the globalist view of how they're using and interpreting human rights. And I mean, I think this has been almost or over a decade ago, and it was very precision. So talk about that a little bit in terms of what they mean by human rights and what conservatives need to understand that they mean by human rights.
Well, sure, Jenna. And there's a big difference between human rights and the International Criminal Court. First of all, the ICC is very specifically, you know, about crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, you know, war crimes and the crime of aggression. And they're listed. I mean, there's murder, extermination, enslavement, rape, torture. I mean, these are heinous crimes. You know, they also have added to their list things like not using lasers to intentionally blind people. So they get very specific in some cases. But that's very different from human rights. I mean, the United Nations has issued many human rights treaties. And what I wrote in that article is actually just a few years ago. Maybe it seems like a decade.
Maybe my life in business seemed like it's a decade ago because I've been through so much. But
you know. I know. You've, okay. You've lived a lifetime in the last 4 years, Jenna. That's
so
for sure.
True.
But there's a tension between, in the article, I talk about the tension between national sovereignty and human rights. And there's this internationalist, globalist effort to just impose this idea of human rights on every country. And who gets to decide whether there's a violation or not? I mean, that's what this is about. Do we have foreign appointed judges deciding whether our officials, and remember, President Bush, General Schwarzkopf, Colin Powell, Dick Cheney have all been accused of war crimes going back, you know, decades. Even recently, Donald Rumsfeld, Alberto Gonzalez. You know, so we've had people who have been accused of war crimes who are American officials, and this happens in other countries too. So it's a very real concern. There is an effort to impose a globalist governance on the world. The United Nations as the lawmaker, the treaties as the law, and courts such as the ICC. And there is a move to create a world court of human rights where anyone could potentially be indicted and then tried or complained against and then tried for violating people's human rights. And so what are human rights? Well, whatever anybody wants to call a human right, they can call a human right. People throw this idea around very casually. You know, there are human rights treaties about the Convention on the Rights of the Child. There's human rights treaties on conventions of rights of persons with disabilities. These are treaties written under the auspices of the United Nations. They're not passed by national legislatures. Yes, the United States has a veto on the Security Council, but they never exercise it to, veto a treaty. And states can decide whether they want to sign on to these treaties or not. And that's fine. If countries want to sign on to treaties, that's fine. The question is, as it relates to international law, who holds the countries accountable? And one of the base principles of international law going back for centuries is this idea of consent, that countries consent to jurisdiction and they hold themselves accountable. It's not other organizations and other groups holding those countries accountable. But that's been shifting and changing as we see these human rights treaties. We see attempts to create these courts like the ICC, and then countries are distancing themselves from holding people accountable. And that's really what the move of global governance is about, is it's about separating national sovereignty and countries holding people accountable and holding themselves accountable to unelected, appointed other people holding themselves accountable. It is concerning. It is a movement, and this is part of it.
Yeah. So in other words, for these treaties that more of the globalists want nations to sign on to would be ceding our own national sovereignty, that instead of being, for example, under our highest law of the land here in America, the United States Constitution, we would then be ceding jurisdiction to some other foreign body that could hold the United States and its leaders accountable under some form of international law instead of holding ourselves accountable. Like for example, what has gone on in several of the recent impeachments one didn't get a trial. And then, of course, Donald Trump was tried twice. But that was according to our own United States law. It wasn't because some foreign entity wanted to impose punishment on leaders of any party in the United States. And you had pointed this out in our discussion years ago, however many years ago it was, about this particular provision of Article 6 in the Constitution, which I wasn't aware of until you pointed this out to me, about the concern of treaties becoming essentially part of our Constitution, mm-hmm. because Article 6, Section 2 says this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And so this has become a way that we have ceded our national sovereignty through treaties because of this provision.
That's exactly right, Jenna. And the Supreme Court has addressed this, and fortunately they've addressed it in a way that is helpful, but it is troubling. And of course, you think back to the founders and what they thought by treaties, and treaties were treaties of commerce, treaties like, cooperation agreements, or, not relating to how we administer justice to our own citizens in the areas of criminal law or even in the area of human rights. I mean, human rights, whether, people would like to say you have a right to food, you have a right to a job, you have a right to Social Security. These are some of the human rights that people want to point to, and they want to use external sources to impose those kinds of positive, legal entitlements on our government from outside. And that's why we have to be very careful with treaties, because, as you just pointed out, Article 6 makes treaties equal to basically federal law. The Constitution of the United States is and should always be the supreme law of the land, and anything in conflict with it should be determined to be unconstitutional, although I question whether that's, the judges in our country want to do that anymore with the kinds of decisions we see in some cases. But that's why the Senate is so important, because the Senate can reject treaties. But even if a treaty slips through, the Supreme Court has said, look, there are treaties that are self-executing and non-self-executing, and if it's a non-self-executing treaty, which most treaties are non-self-executing, which just means that within the treaty, it doesn't say this is going to become the law, and it provides provisions that are able to be implemented. And there's an argument over whether treaties are self-executing and non-self-executing, but the court has held that generally treaties are non-self-executing, which means that the legislature, either the Congress and then state courts also, state legislatures would have to take action to actually implement the provisions of a treaty. So, for example, the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities, if the United States had ratified that treaty, which it did not, it rejected that treaty, we already have a federal law on, the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. So we treat people here in the United States with disabilities better than most countries in the world. What do we need a treaty for, telling us how to do that, and then giving over the adjudication of whether we're complying with those treaty provisions to some other external source? I mean, we should not do that. We fought a revolution in 1776 for the right to govern ourselves. And ultimately, that's what this is about. Who is going to decide whether our people are guilty or what laws we're going to live under? That's what
right.
it's about.
Right. And that makes so much sense. And, you know, and just another real world example, you mentioned the Convention on Rights of the Child, which the United States has not signed on to, which would undercut parental rights in the United States. And rather than our own justice system and courts and domestic relations courts being able to determine, and our legislatures be able to determine parental rights for citizens of the United States, it would be ceding a lot of that authority to a foreign body. And when we sign on to these treaties, then we can't unilaterally amend them like we could if it's, for example, federal law. Well, the federal Congress can always change or amend that, and it's still in-house within the United States. And another example was the USMCA, which President Trump very much touted and was a great replacement for the NAFTA agreement, but built into that language, Canada wanted a provision for SOGI language, or sexual orientation gender identity language, that would compel and require our federal employment law to recognize and provide those types of protections that Canada wanted for people who identify under the SOGI language, that our Congress has yet to ratify or to legislate on. So they wanted to kind of sneak it through a treaty provision. And that was a big deal, especially to a lot of conservative organizations back then, that, you know, President Trump and his administration was so focused on the other provisions that the administration didn't really seem to be all that concerned about those types of language. And so and that ended up getting resolved pretty well. And we could, you know, go into the details later. But ultimately, if those types of provisions are able to be embedded into treaties, how does the Supreme Court, or how should the Supreme Court, view that type of language if it is in conflict with our current federal law, or, and especially, our U.S. Constitution?
That's a great question, and it points out why judges and the appointment of judges is so important, because it is possible for there to be confusion created by these treaties, because what will happen is, you know, it'll start at the federal district court, and then it'll go to the appeals court. And there are plenty of judges who are globalists, who are internationalists, who want to advance this idea of global governance, and they want to find treaties where they can do this. And you know, the Supreme Court doesn't take every case. I mean, the Supreme Court has hundreds, thousands of requests every year, and they can only take 80 to 100, and they can't decide every one. So they got to rely on judges to make these kinds of determinations. Eventually, over time, it'll get there. But it does create the opportunity for confusion. And this is one of those. This treaty, you know, you could see a federal court judge saying, oh, yeah, look, there's SOGI language in this treaty, and therefore, you know, you guys have to apply this and rule in favor. And it may or may not get appealed. Circuit Court may or may not uphold it, and Supreme Court may or may not take it. So judges are very important. So it's not just about the treaty itself and the Senate. The Senate can ratify a treaty like the USMCA if it's not looking carefully at these issues. I think the USMCA might be one of those treaties that was considered self-executing. And so that could be problematic. I haven't heard of that provision being used in a court case yet, but I mean, my goodness, there are so many issues being dealt with in court these days. It's hard to keep up with all of them, Jenna. And you point out a very important concern, though.
Well, and you've pointed it out and brought it, you know, to my attention. And in that that instance of the USMCA, I mean, the resolution was there ended up being a footnote to that provision, basically saying that it wasn't binding on federal law when in conflict, which, whether or not that is ultimately, if it was litigated, whether that is sufficient to overcome the language that ended up being in the USMCA is potentially an issue for a court at another time. But this is why it's so important that, and listeners need to understand, that some of the threats to our national sovereignty, to our rights, to our very, the American ability to govern ourselves and to preserve and protect our own rights. I mean, we the people is referencing Americans. All of these things are very important when we're talking about the potential to erode our freedom and erode our national sovereignty. And when you have the Biden administration and even, bad actors in a Republican administration like Trump's or a future Republican administration that isn't concerned or intentionally is trying to embed some of these provisions, we need to understand how this may impact us, because I think a lot of people are so focused just on good interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, and that's critical ground. But we also need to be concerned more broadly about some of these treaties, about international law, and how, some of these things can affect our own sovereignty. So Mike, in the last few minutes that I have with you in this segment, I want to shift gears and ask you about one other headline that came out yesterday. This is coming from the Daily Mail. A West Virginia court rules that gender-affirming surgery should be paid for by the taxpayer in a landmark decision. So speaking about bad courts, the federal appeals court is the first to say the state must cover gender surgeries. State officials said their policy was based on financial concerns, not bias, and the gender-affirming surgery must be paid for by state health care plans, a Richmond court has ruled. So hopefully the U.S. Supreme Court will take this up. But my problem with this, beyond the obvious, is that there's also a line of precedent that says the individual taxpayer has no standing to challenge this in court, which frustrates me as a taxpayer because I don't want to give my dollars to Ukraine, much less gender-affirming surgery if I'm somebody in West Virginia. So what do you make of this case, and how might this go to the Supreme Court?
Well, Jenna, I live in West Virginia, and so this affects me personally as well. And I would note that the Attorney General in West Virginia, Patrick Morrissey, who is running for governor, has promised that he is appealing this case, and he is completely against the court's ruling. I don't know, folks listening may or may not get my next little joke here, inside lawyer joke, but I like to call the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals the new Ninth. When I was in law school and going through the 2000s, the Ninth Circuit was the place where you expected to get these crazy decisions, trying to reshape society in some left fashion or progressive fashion. You don't see the Ninth doing that so much anymore. Now you see the Fourth Circuit doing this kind of stuff. And it's not just in this area, it's in a lot of other areas. So I do think that this will probably find its way to the Supreme Court. But you never know. So we'll see what happens. I mean, this is an equal protection challenge. And in North Carolina and West Virginia, the state Medicare plans have said, look, we're not going to pay for sex change operations. That's an elected thing if they want to. And, we're having a national debate over this, and 24, 25 states have said, no, you can't do that to kids. Okay, there's a question about whether you can do it as an adult, whether it's for kids, and it's shocking to me that we've come to this place where we're saying, yeah, it's okay to mutilate children and use puberty blockers, but thankfully a lot of states have gotten involved and said, no, that's not okay, you can't do that here. But that's it.
And I think we're potentially losing Mike. So we'll try to reestablish that connection, Devin. But I completely agree that this is ridiculous that we are paying with our own taxpayer funded state healthcare plans to pay for gender affirming surgery. And I'm told that we have Mike back. So I was just being outraged in the break while we lost you, Mike, but go ahead.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah,
that's
so,
okay.
So anyway, getting back to the point of the case here, this particular case, the court basically tried to twist itself into a pretzel and say, this is an equal protection case, saying that, it's based, this idea of sex and whether you get to choose your sex and whether the state should pay for you to have a sex change, is something they think you can do. They say that it's wrong to treat people differently on the basis of differences. I mean, it's confusing. It's very confusing. I read the court's majority opinion. it was really, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I've read hundreds of thousands of court opinions. I mean, it's so hard to follow their logic. And when you read the dissent, which six judges dissented, saying, look, this is not really a hard case. They're not discriminating against people on the basis of sex. They're just saying, look, we're not going to cover this kind of treatment for this purpose. You know, it's like some health plans don't cover pregnancy-related, illnesses. Does that mean that they're discriminating on the basis of sex and therefore they can't do that? I mean, the court has ruled directly on that case and said, no, it's okay for health plans to not cover pregnancy. Is that wrong? Maybe it is, but the courts have upheld it. This kind of new world in which we are and arguing over what is sex, what isn't sex, what's gender identity, and what kinds of things the taxpayers should have to pay for or not pay for is it's a new world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we'll have to start calling it the Fourth Circus, like we've been calling it the Ninth Circus. Yeah. So we're getting into a couple of those. But, you know, at least the West Virginia court did not refer to or invoke the spirit of aloha in, you know, determining their rationale like the Hawaii Supreme Court did recently. I mean, these are just things that are so beyond any sort of rational explanation or exposition of the law, and to then go outside of any sort of rational basis, just to, as you said, Mike, to just manipulate themselves into a pretzel to get to the outcome that they want is the very definition of judicial activism. And this is why, as you said previously, and I completely agree, this is why good judges matter, not just at the Supreme Court, because this case may not get to the Supreme Court. I hope that that Morrissey is able to do that, and we've had him on the program many times, and he's excellent, and I'm glad he's running for governor, but they may or may not take it up, and so this is why we also need good federal judges at all levels. But Mike Donnelly, really appreciate your time. We're already out of time for this segment. I had more questions, but follow Mike Donnelly on X. He's at Donnelly Speaks, and his byline is constitutionalist opinionated. This is why he is one of my best friends, because both of those things are really great. All right, we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies, and that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. All right, so we need to talk about Kristi Noem and her dog, her former dog. This is just an absolutely crazy story on multiple levels. And as all of you know, I'm obviously very, very biased in terms of my perspective on the story, just from the factual parts of this story, because I happen to have two dogs, Todd and Copper, which regular listeners know and love, and you can follow them at Two Dudes, DOODS _ Copper and Todd. And I've had dogs my whole life, and I love dogs, and I think they're just man's best friend, and part of God's creatures. Now, if we want to talk about spiders, I think that in the garden, they were much cuter. It is a result of the fall that spiders look so evil. Now, whether that's theologically accurate or not, I don't know. But anyway, so all of that to say, I am somebody who absolutely loves dogs. And my initial reaction to this story was just, I was horrified, but also on a political scale, thinking, what in the world is this woman doing? So she has a new book out. And if you haven't heard this story, then you may be like a number of others who only get your news. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with this, but this is part of what I think is actually fascinating about this story, that you may only get your political news from here at AFR, which is great, but also some of the other sources like Fox News or Newsmax, which have not talked about this story at all and are, in my view, covering for Kristi Noem being an absolute idiot by putting this story in her book as she is potentially being considered for vice president on the Trump ticket. So what she did in this book was write, and it's kind of a memoir. She wrote this vignette about having a hunting dog, and when this little dog was a 14-month-old puppy, was apparently untrainable and showing signs of aggression toward a neighbor's chickens and going after them. And Kristi Noem literally wrote, "I hated that dog," according to the reports of the book. And she wrote, "I hated that dog." So she describes very graphically taking the dog to a gravel pit, and the dog is trying to nip at her and bite her, which I'm thinking, okay, the dog probably knows and can sense fear and can sense that she hates the dog. I mean, all dogs know instinctively whether you love them or not. I mean, kind of like kids in a way, right? I mean, they know if you care about them or not. So Kristi Noem is justifying her behavior by saying, you know, the dog showed signs of aggression at 14 months old. Drags the dog to a gravel pit, gets her gun, and shoots the dog in the face. Later that day, apparently also shoots and kills one of her goats for some other inexplicable reason that I'm sure she also graphically describes in her book. Now, this, of course, outraged a lot of people who love dogs, and there was a lot of online... I mean, this was the number one trending story in the world over the weekend, because so many people were outraged that not just that this happened about 20 years ago, but that Kristi Noem would put this in her book and then try to justify this for political purposes, try to justify this as an example of her willingness to make tough decisions. And so she writes on social media in response to the backlash, "As I explained in the book, it wasn't easy," she said on X, formerly known as Twitter, "but often the easy way isn't the right way." And I just have to sit back and say, first of all, what kind of person does this 20 years ago? Then she also describes how her young daughter got off the school bus coming home from school and asked, "Where's Cricket, the dog?" I mean, so clearly her daughter had bonded with the dog and was asking where the puppy was. And she had to explain to her daughter that earlier that day she'd taken it out to a gravel pit and summarily executed it. Instead of, you know, and she also wrote in the book that the dog was a less than worthless hunting dog. So it was a working dog. And apparently because in Kristi Noem's mind, the dog couldn't fulfill her obligations on the farm, then she had to go and shoot the dog. So my personal view is, you know, if dogs are showing signs of aggression, particularly toward humans, I mean, there are a lot of examples of especially certain breeds of dogs that are very aggressive toward humans and may need to be put down in those instances. As much as I'm a dog lover, obviously protecting humans is important, but you do so in a humane way. And that's also the last resort. That's the last option. Did she even try to go and give the dog to a shelter to rehome it, maybe with a family who actually cared about the dog, didn't say, "I hated that dog," didn't think it was less than worthless? I mean, a 14-month-old puppy. So a lot of people, I mean, myself included, who have had many dogs and have trained many dogs, when you're a 14-month-old puppy, especially that breed, I mean, we're not talking about a pit bull or, you know, something, that, a dog that is generally, you know, the breed is known for aggression. I'm thinking then that's probably the fault of the owner. I mean, just like if you go out to a restaurant and kids are absolutely yelling, and I know from, you know, being around my nephews and niece, sometimes there are just meltdowns and toddlers are little tiny people that sometimes, you know, just cannot control themselves, and that's okay. But if it's a repeatedly habitual behavior of actually bad behavior, that speaks more to the lack of discipline on the parent from the parent than it does the child. Because, I mean, we are even taught in scripture that discipline is a good thing, that the parent who loves their child disciplines them. And the same principle applies even even to dogs. But the political aspect to this story to me is just so wild that consider this, that Kristi Noem, in the midst of vying and being one of the reportedly top contenders for the VP ticket, she and whoever else vetted this book that is just coming out to try to heighten her her popularity with the GOP base, actually thought that this story would engender her and ingratiate her to the GOP base. What does that say about the political consultant class? And further, what does that say about outlets like Fox, Newsmax, and others that have not covered this story and are providing cover for her just in case, in my view, likely, because they know that this is a bad story for Kristi Noem. It's gotten, I mean, even conservatives are just saying, no, that this is her. I mean, the best response that I saw on social media was Kristi Noem proverbially took her political career out to the gravel pit and shot it in the face. And I agree with that. I mean, there's no coming back from this. The same, you know, as Mitt Romney with the story of tying his dog to the roof of the car or whatever that was. And he got, you know, just so much flack for it. I mean, this is even worse. And yet the mouthpieces for the Republican Party are flying cover for her. And so what you have to understand about these outlets, and you know, if you watch Fox News and you watch some of these other outlets, know that they have a bias and know that they have a perspective. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with having a bias or a perspective. I mean, here at AFR, we are very openly Christian. We are very openly evangelical Christian. We are very openly coming from a biblical worldview perspective. So you're never going to hear me advocating for policy positions or cultural implications or anything that is inconsistent with biblical truth. And we're very open about that. And so listeners just know that's the perspective we're coming from. That's fine. But just know that the perspective and the bias that the conservative, quote unquote, or really it's more the Republican mouthpiece outlets are coming from is just that. They're not news. I mean, just like how you know if you watch MSNBC, their bias absolutely is going to be leftist and even, I would say, Marxist. If you're listening to Rachel Maddow or, you know, Jory Reid and some of those others, I mean, that's just the perspective they're coming from. And so don't think that that's only the leftist media. Right-wing media, and I don't even want to call it conservative because I don't think it is, but right-wing media is also coming from that bias. And a lot of news outlets and print outlets are that way as well. And so just know that going in. But then also the response from some conservatives who and these social media influencers and, you know, who knows what their payment, you know, plan is and their other connections, or if they just want to ingratiate themselves as well to, you know, the Republican Party, the RNC and MAGA and all of that. And again, nothing wrong with that, but you need to know if they come from that bias. What they have done is then framed this as saying, well, where's the outrage over unborn children? Which I'm thinking, okay, fair that we need to be outraged over abortion, but that is such a non sequitur. We can be outraged against the summary execution of a 14-month-old puppy at the same time that we can be outraged over the abortion debate in America. These are not two mutually exclusive topics. If you care about puppies, you don't care about babies anymore. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that some right-wing influencers use the very same tactics as the left of this whataboutism. Stay on track. If we like what Kristi Noem did and you want to defend that, defend it for its own sake. Don't point to something else. Otherwise, what are you doing? We're already out of time. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.